Today on Against the Grain, the industrial workers of the world, or Wobblies, are justly celebrated on the left for their militant opposition to capitalism, their broad church unionism across race and gender lines, and their ability to organize migrant and other precarious workers. As Ahmed White documents, they were crushed with unprecedented violence and vigilantism, which cast a long shadow over the U.S. labor movement and the left. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Founded in 1905, the industrial workers of the world were a remarkable union, bringing together skilled and unskilled workers across the country and beyond U.S. borders in opposition to the wage system. And they were met with perhaps the most severe campaign of legal repression and extra-legal violence in American history, culminating in the Red Scare of the late teens and early 1920s. In Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers, which is published by the University of California Press, labor and legal historian Ahmed White explores the degree to which the members of the IWW were persecuted in an attempt to keep them from ever organizing again, often with the complicity and involvement of liberals from President Woodrow Wilson to Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. White is Nicholas Rosenbaum Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also the author of The Last Great Strike, Little Steel, The CIO, and The Struggle for Labor Rights in New Deal America. Ahmed, what would you say set the Wobblies apart from other unions of their day?
Several things, I think. One is their politics, or in some ways lack of that. They were an overtly revolutionary union committed to bringing down the system of wage labor. And they were quite serious about that, much more so than most unions of their day. I say the lack of politics because they rejected the idea of what was called a political or parliamentary socialism. In fact, they had a kind of consuming contempt for the political process, which they regarded as a bound servant of capitalist rule. On top of that, the Wobblies were, I think, distinguished by who composed the organization. By the mid and late 19-teens, the union was heavily composed of migratory workers, overwhelmingly men, although there are some notable exceptions to that, most of them in the western two-thirds of the country, and most of them semi-skilled or low-skilled workers. And that distinguished them from most other unions of the day, as did the fact that the IWW was an industrial union organized on an industrial basis at a time when most, but not all, other unions in the country tended to be organized around craft or particular skill levels, and composed mainly of skilled workers, or at least semi-skilled workers, and very few of these unions back then, other than the IWW, organized unskilled workers. And then finally, I would say the IWW was distinguished by its openness to organizing not only unskilled workers on an industrial basis, but all workers with no regard for sex, for race, for ethnicity. This at a time when most unions were on one level or another pretty exclusionary and tended to be composed mainly of white male workers, and essentially had a policy of not organizing people who didn't have those sort of demographic attributes.
So this was a time of really tremendous class conflict and violence. which may be striking to people who are more aware of the latter half of 20th century U.S. labor history. Can you tell us of the successes and ebbs and flows of the industrial workers of the world in the period before World War I?
Yes, so the union was formed in the summer of 1905, and for the better part of a decade, it kind of struggled to find its footing, to settle for itself a way to achieve its stated purposes, which were to organize the industrial working class, to eventually the Wobblies, as the members of the organization were almost universally called, to eventually bring down the wage labor system by launching a vast general strike composed of the majority of the workers in the economy in this country, if not in the whole world. Well, the organization never came close to that, but in its first decade or so, it had difficulty making any progress towards that goal. The members it organized often melted away. The union was very adept at taking hold of strikes that emerged more or less spontaneously. The scenario is often one where the IWW had a few workers in a community, had recruited a few workers in a community, didn't really have a functional presence there. But once a strike arose spontaneously, as was often the case, the union was well situated to kind of take control of the strike, to exert influence over it, and to recruit members. It just seemed unable to hold those members for more than a few months after the end of the strike, even when the strike resulted in some kind of victory for the workers. So this was a story in several of the union's most most acclaimed strikes. Strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, the so-called Bread and Roses strike, the strike the next year in Paterson, New Jersey, followed this course, where the union again was able to exert a great deal of influence over pretty large strikes and recruit a goodly number of members, in both cases roughly 10,000 or so members. And then within a year or so, sometimes less, those members would melt away. And so for a decade or so, the IWW existed only as a small organization. And struggled really as well to kind of put itself on a firm financial and organizational footing. And this was all amidst a great deal of repression and violence aimed at the union. And these big strikes were characterized by mass arrest and violence and in some cases killings and the prosecutions of Wobblies, of workers in general, but especially Wobblies who were involved in the strikes. And this went on again for the better part of a decade. So the union managed, ironically, without ever building a firm membership base, to nevertheless establish itself as an organization to be feared by people who were intent on defending the status quo.
To what do you attribute the challenge that the industrial workers of the world had in keeping members? Was some of this due to the degree of repression or the fact that, as you mentioned, a lot of these workers were migrant workers, so they might not be fixed in one place? Were there other factors?
You put your finger on an important cause here, and that's repression. I think it clearly deterred people from retaining their membership in the organization when it was, as the Wobblies later joked about, the membership card, the red card that union members carried was a ticket to the penitentiary. That was clearly a factor. Another factor was just a lack of organizational acumen on the part of the union itself, especially in its first 10 years of existence. Not to say that the union and its leadership didn't do some things right, but they just seemed unable to come up with a program that worked for collecting dues, for delivering representation, for maintaining kind of consistent services to their members. This, I think, reflected something fundamental about the IWW's position in the world that characterized it through all of its existence in the first half of the 20th century. And that is the tension between operating as a conventional union that offered its members representation, that achieved collective bargaining agreements with employers, that improved their day-to-day working conditions, versus operating as a revolutionary organization. That created tensions, if not kind of contradictions, within the organization that it never really, during this period, sorted out. And it ultimately, these conflicts manifested themselves in a schism that ended up tearing the organization apart.
Your book focuses on the tremendous repression that was meted out to the industrial workers of the world during a period which is known as the period of the Red Scare, something that, as you note, it has been really forgotten in U.S. history. And traditional accounts of that time talk about or write about how the U.S. entry into World War I led to a wave of repression through a period that then ebbed after the 1920s. But you note that the repression of the industrial workers of the world actually preceded the period that is the lead up to U.S. entry into World War I. Can you describe for us, as you see it, the unfolding of events that led to heretofore unseen levels of repression in the United States?
Yes, so the you're quite right that the IWW began to face escalating repression many months before the United States entered the First World War. By the summer of 1916, at least, this was showing itself, and it not by coincidence emerged in concert with the union finally finding its footing as a viable organization. As I noted a minute ago, it never resolved this contradiction between being a conventional union and a revolutionary organization. And on top of that, the union continued to have to struggle with or could continue to face struggles internally about that issue. Nevertheless, by 1916, the organization had settled upon a very effective way of organizing, especially migratory workers, and particularly out west. And this involved mainly the innovation of sending organizers out among the workers themselves, and in some ways loosening the definition of what an organizer was. Creating a situation in which almost anyone who belonged to the union could assert himself as an organizer. This created a great deal of flexibility in organizing, and it allowed organizers to reach workers in remote places, often in hobo encampments or on the job itself, and organize them sometimes in small numbers, but on a vast scale. And so by the summer of 1916, the union had employed this strategy to make great inroads in organizing first migratory harvest workers on the Great Plains. And then from there, lumber workers, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, and later construction workers, dock workers, and oil workers. And this all began to unfold rather quickly in this period. Again, 1916 was, I think, the key moment. And so by the end of that year, prominent Western capitalist and their allies in state government were intent on destroying the organization, and began to see the war, the impending entry of the United States into the war, as an opportunity to cast their opposition to the IWW and the need to destroy the organization as a mandate of patriotism and military preparation. And that is what I think, above all else, made the destruction of the IWW so central to the war, and such a prominent thing during the years of American involvement in the war.
Labor and legal scholar Ahmed White is my guest. His book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers, published by UC Press, is the subject of our conversation today. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Can you tell us what role liberals played, that is progressives with a capital P, in supporting the repression of the industrial workers of the world, from President Woodrow Wilson to much revered Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes?
Liberals, or progressives, as they tended to be called back then, played in many ways quite a prominent role in the destruction of the Union and the repression it faced. I should say from the outset, it certainly wasn't the case with all liberals or progressives. Some supported the Union, offering legal representation, agitating for an end to the repression that the organization faced. But you're quite right that this was not the destruction of the Union, a project exclusively or even primarily in the hands of conservatives. It was people like Wilson, people like Oliver Wendell Holmes or Louis Brandeis, who in various ways either authored or endorsed what was done to the organization. And this was true all the way down to the local level, through the state legislatures and state governor's offices, to local prosecutors and sheriffs. Everywhere I looked in researching this book and researching the kind of repression the Union faced, I found repeatedly the hand of self-avowed progressives who were quite aggressive in their attacks on the Union, and who played a decisive role in ultimately bringing it to its knees. I think that obviously raises the question, why would that be? And I think the reason was in some ways rather simple, that the IWW, that progressives were not revolutionaries, and many of them were quite intolerant of the Union's revolutionary ambitions, and they aimed to defeat it for that reason. On top of that, I think these Wobblies offended the middle class sensibilities that dominated progressive or liberal politics in that period. These were again mostly men, mostly on the younger side, very rough people on the margins of American society, whose values simply were not those of most progressives, and who, in fact, didn't apologize for that. Quite the opposite. The IWW's literature in this period, and there was very considerable amount of it. The Union had dozens and dozens of newspapers, pamphlets, you name it, celebrated the fact that they were workers. They were separate and apart from the middle classes, and those publications expressed a certain contempt for middle class culture. And that, if one wants to put it that way, didn't help the Union's image in the eyes of much of the liberal or progressive community in that period.
Well, you've noted already that the repression against the industrial workers of the world preceded the U.S. entry into World War I, preceded, in fact, the Russian Revolution. But I wanted to ask you, to what degree did the Russian Revolution affect the levels of repression that took place in the United States against the industrial workers of the world and other leftists?
I think above all else, it helped extend the Red Scare. As the revolution weathered the headwinds that it faced in the first few months or a couple of years after it occurred, this created a kind of ongoing or abiding fear of what it might portend. And of course, the end of the war in Europe brought uprisings, often styled after the Bolshevik Revolution, in a number of places. And there was a fear of that manifesting itself here in the United States, one that was, I think, aggravated by the formation of so-called Soviets in a number of American cities, including in the Pacific Northwest, in places where the IWW was active. And these Soviets tended to be comprised of kind of coalitions of IWWs, of socialists of whatever caste, and disaffected workers, often disaffected, demobilized servicemen. This fed the fears of a broader uprising, as did, ironically, the formation of the Communist Party. I say ironically because the Communist and the IWW very soon ended up as rivals. But the formation of communist groups in the wake of the First World War, the armistice, out of the Socialist Party, gave impetus to this idea that that the country faced a general uprising from the left, and one that had to be preempted at all cost. And the IWW ended up, because it was very much already in existence, it's very visible, and it was, as they say, an above ground organization, made a convenient target for that. And so I think in that way, the revolution ended up contributing to continued repression of the organization, even though, again, the irony is that the IWW very soon found itself as a rival to and at odds with the communist movement.
What forms of legal repression were marshaled against the industrial workers of the world?
So there were three things that were done to the union in that way, three kinds of legal repression that the organization primarily faced. One was federal prosecution, primarily under the Espionage Act, a statute that, as many people know, is still on the books, although amended from its form back then. It was enacted in the spring and early summer of 1917. In part with the idea of using it to persecute the IWW and socialist dissidents to the war and to the industrial system. The way it was used against the IWW was pretty straightforward. The argument was that the legal theory was that the IWW, or the people prosecuted, were part of a conspiracy to interfere with the war effort. And that this put them in violation of the Espionage Act. That's significant that the claim was conspiracy, because conspiracy is a pretty easy crime to prove. You don't have to prove much in the way of any what we call an overt act, that these people actually did anything to undermine the war effort. You mainly only have to prove that they agreed among themselves to a plan that would involve this. Now, there's still debate about what the IWW did, but I think the general consensus is there was actually no conspiracy to undermine the war effort. The union was prosecuted instead because it actually engaged in a number of fairly successful strikes during the months leading up to and in the first period of American involvement in the war. So there were three big prosecutions under the Espionage Act, one in Chicago, one in Sacramento, and another in Kansas, eventually in Kansas City, in which the better part of 200 members of the union were successfully prosecuted and sentenced, most of them to prison. The second way that the union was repressed by legal means was via what were called criminal syndicalism laws. These were state-level laws for the most part. There were some municipal criminal syndicalism statutes. State-level laws enacted mostly between the late winter, early spring of 1917 and 1921, 1922, in about 20 states, most of them west of the Mississippi River. And in every case, these laws were enacted for the express purpose of criminalizing the IWW. The way they did it was pretty straightforward and in a way kind of ingenious. What these statutes did was to make it a crime not only to advocate what was called in the statutes industrial or political change by criminal means, including notably sabotage, but also to make it a crime to belong to an organization that advocated political or industrial change by such means. This created what one scholar or advocate at the time, advocate for the IWW at the time, called constructive conspiracy. In other words, a way of prosecuting people that was even easier than conventional conspiracy law, because all the prosecutors really had to prove was that the person being charged was a member of the union, and then put on a bunch of evidence to paint the union as a nefarious, seditious organization. That was easy enough to do by mustering the union's own literature, which was often inflammatory in nature. Hundreds of IWW members were successfully prosecuted and imprisoned for violating these criminal syndicalism laws. And they were very effective and useful because they could be deployed by county prosecutors fairly cheaply without the mobilization, the kinds of resources that were necessary to effect these federal prosecutions. And they could be brought to bear wherever the union was active. You didn't have to employ the kind of cumbersome machinery of federal prosecution to do this. So this was the second major kind of legal repression the organization faced. And the third kind, and by far the most common, was prosecution for violating local vagrancy laws. Everywhere these IWWs went, they were subject to being arrested and charged with vagrancy. And very often the pattern was, if the union became particularly active somewhere or was thought to be active, then its members were rounded up, sometimes in great numbers, sometimes dozens, sometimes scores, sometimes even hundreds at a time would be arrested. Usually because the jails were had limited capacity, this was a way of running them out of town, especially if it was a large number arrested. But quite a few were prosecuted for this, put in the local jail or on the local chain gang or something like that for 10 days, 20 days, sometimes as long as 6 months. The beauty of this kind of prosecution was that it was the cheapest way, the most efficient way of all, for bringing the law to bear against these organizations. The kind of procedures that were necessary to prosecute someone for vagrancy were very minimal. It was often a question of being arrested by the sheriff or local police, brought down to the station, stood before a police magistrate or someone like that, in a trial that lasted a matter of seconds, and in which there was essentially no defense, because vagrancy laws were so broadly drafted that that almost anyone on the face of things was guilty if they were brought before the magistrate anyway. And the fact these people were IWWs was really the only operative element of guilt. And so again, thousands upon thousands of Wobblies were prosecuted for vagrancy. It was a very effective way of repressing the organization, disrupting its organizing efforts, and punishing people who dared to join it.
I'm speaking with Ahmed White. He teaches labor and criminal law at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's the author of Under the Iron Heel, the Wobblies and the capitalist war on radical workers. UC Press has published that book. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Ahmed, you were just describing the various forms, legal forms, of repression of the IWW or the Wobblies during the period of World War I and after. But you also describe, on top of the mobilization of these various laws and statutes to go after the Wobblies, something which one person described as bourgeois vigilantism, or kind of extra legal actions. What kind of actions were taken against members of the IWW, and who carried them out?
So the extra legal repression the organization faced consisted of any number of things, from well-organized attacks on the organization, on the union's members, sometimes with the official or semi-official sanction of local police or local prosecutors, to random acts of brutality inflicted upon them, as it were, on the fly, by local toughs, by American Legionnaires, by members of commercial clubs, by that sort of thing. There was, though, a common theme running through this, that these vigilante attacks tended to be associated with, to occur, in places where the union seemed especially prominent and seemed to be making inroads in organizing workers. This generated the ire of the people who were the authors of these attacks. And so you have some fairly notorious episodes like what happened in Everett, Washington in 1916, when a shipload of Wobblies coming into that town from Seattle was intercepted at the dock and attacked by a mob of about 200 people led by the local sheriff, a progressive. That resulted in the deaths of anywhere from 6 to maybe 12, 12 Wobblies who were shot dead by this mob before they could disembark their vessel. Or another notorious episode in Centralia, just in November 1919, when the Wobbly Hall there, which had been attacked numerous times by vigilantes, was finally attacked in the course of an Armistice Day parade. That time, the Wobblies had prepared themselves and were armed, awaiting this attack, and they fired back, killing several American Legionnaires who led the assault on the Union Hall, and this resulted in the lynching of one of the Wobblies and the successful prosecution of several of those who were involved in, several Wobblies who were involved in this in this affair, and their imprisonment for second degree murder. So these were some of the more notable and more notorious affairs. But one of the points I try to make in the book, again, is that for every one of these major incidents of extra legal repression of vigilantism, there were many, many more smaller scale events that that just never attained that kind of notoriety, but played an important role nonetheless in repressing the union and making it a very dangerous thing to be, to belong to this organization.
Would you say this kind of, I don't know if you'd call it grassroots reactionary violence, was typical of the era, or was this particularly mobilized in this moment against the industrial workers of the world?
Well, this was the period in which lynchings predominated or were very common. Racial lynchings and a few others, lynchings of criminal defendants who happened not to be black or Latino or whatnot. So this was a time when this kind of extra legal violence was hardly unheard of. And the Wobblies were in some ways victims of that, of this culture of violence. The other thing that I think tended to promote it was, interestingly enough, the tremendous courage of the Wobblies themselves, who in many ways thought nothing of inviting this kind of violence. As a number of authors, a couple of authors have in various ways noted, the Wobblies by the late 19-teens had about themselves a kind of, had built about themselves a kind of cult of physical courage. And this was expressed in, again, this indifference and sometimes verging on a kind of inviting attitude towards confrontation, including violent confrontation. And not because the IWW imagined itself a violent organization. The union wasn't pacifist, but it was very clear in its view that that it regarded violence as something legitimate in self-defense, but not as a primary means of prosecuting its revolutionary purposes. And so by the time that this great wave of repression sort of gathered strength, many Wobblies were, you know, not at all afraid of provoking the people who ended up committing these vigilante acts. So I mentioned this episode in Everett, Washington that resulted in the shooting deaths of a number of IWWs on this ferry boat at the dock. Well, the reason those people were there was to confront a group led by the local sheriff that had for many weeks at that point already inflicted serious violence on Wobblies who came into that town trying to organize workers. They had, in one episode, rounded up dozens of these union people and beat them severely, brought them out in the country, beat them again, injuring some of them pretty seriously, and sent them on their way. Well, for the Wobblies, this was not something to take lying down. And so the union organized itself in Seattle, organized a couple hundred workers, and said, we're going to go back to that town and we're going to face these people again. And that they did, except, of course, the vigilantes organized by the sheriff were waiting there for them and ended up killing a number of their members. Again, this was an organization of people who put a premium on courage, on courageously prosecuting the union's agenda, even if that meant being beaten, as it often did, and even if it meant being killed, as was sometimes the case.
Labor scholar Ahmed White is speaking with me today about his book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers. I'm Sasha Lilly. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, we've been talking about the repression of the industrial workers of the world in the period leading up to World War I and then following it. But I wanted to ask you about the repression by the U.S. state and also this kind of extra legal vigilante violence against other groups on the left. Was similar violence extended to other radical groupings, or did the industrial workers of the world receive uniquely violent repression?
I think the industrial workers of the world bore the brunt of the repression in the period from, say, 1917 to 1920 or so. And of course, unlike other leftist organizations, continued to face very serious repression for some years thereafter. But other groups were prosecuted and had to deal with extra legal violence in this period. Several hundred socialists were prosecuted under the Espionage Act, along with a great number of pacifist black nationalists. other kinds of dissident organizations. And many of these people were sent to prison right alongside the IWW. And of course, during the height of the Red Scare in the post-war period, thousands of leftists or alleged leftists of various stripes were rounded up, in most of them in a series of raids known as the Palmer Raids that began in November of 1919 and extended into January, early February of 1920. And hundreds and hundreds of these people were deported. Those who weren't citizens were deported. Many of them languished in jail, and a lot of them were beaten in the course of this. And a relative handful of leftists, other than IWWs, were prosecuted under the state criminal syndicalism laws. And so, yes, there was repression meted out to people, to leftists other than IWWs. But the IWW bore the brunt of this, and it endured the repression for far longer, sustained repression for far longer than any other major groups in this period. Again, from sustained repression from 1916 into the mid-1920s, by which time this kind of thing was no longer being done in any significant way to other leftists.
How did the repression that was meted out to members of the Industrial Workers of the World leave lasting marks on them as individuals? And then what was the ramifications of that, of those marks on future organizing?
One of the reasons I wrote the book, and I think it's something reflected in the text, is that I wanted to get at what repression really means and how it does its work and what it means for the people who are the victims of it. Because I think for various reasons, this had not gotten the kind of attention it should have in the studies of the IWW or of anti-radical repression or repression of any kind in this country's history. Aside from individual biographies or maybe some books and articles about particular episodes, it just wasn't a lot of attention to this question. And so I thought this is important. It's interesting. It's also, to my mind, morally compelling, and compelling in a very human way. Let's look at what happened to these people, what they suffered. And what I found was in many ways heartbreaking. Repression worked, in short, by destroying these people's lives, by inflicting incredible hardships on them, locking them up in extraordinarily violent and dirty and dank and cold circumstances, isolating them from their family and friends, humiliating them behind bars, putting them in a position where their lives were, if not destroyed, then turned upside down by what they experienced, and in which in some cases where their health was compromised by their time behind bars. And in many cases where their mental health was permanently damaged by the time they spent in prison. So in the book, there are a couple of accounts of IWW defendants who were sent to prison and went insane and were confined in the asylum as a result of what they experienced. There are several workers, several union members who died in custody or who had their health ruined while they were locked up. And now this occurred in parallel with expressions of the kind of courage I mentioned earlier that were equally extraordinary. So one of the common occurrences in this story of repression is the IWW, or the union's members, being presented with the option of avoiding either conviction in the first place or continued confinement in prison if they renounce the union. Time and time again, and literally hundreds of occasions, these people refused. They said, I will not do that. And in fact, it went even beyond that. When offered the opportunity to leave prison or to avoid prosecution in some cases, with no conditions attached, some of these defendants refused on the grounds that they would stand with their fellow workers, as they call them, their fellow IWWs, and they would endure. There were even a couple cases where defendants volunteered, where workers or union members volunteered to be prosecuted alongside their fellow IWWs, where they hadn't been arrested or they hadn't been charged. And there's one, you know, very moving case of a defendant in one of these big Espionage Act prosecutions, in fact, the biggest of them all in Chicago in 1918, who at sentencing pleaded with the judge to give him the sentence that the judge was about to give to another IWW defendant because that other defendant was needed at home. He said, give me his years, Your Honor. And this kind of thing happened time and again, and it's really extraordinary to behold. But a point I try to make clear in the book is that that didn't negate the fact that that what was done to these people really, in many cases, destroyed them. And by destroying the union's members, by turning their lives upside down, you could destroy the organization itself. To break the union, you had to break the people who were in it. And I think the repression went a long way towards accomplishing that.
Ahmed White, let me conclude by asking you this question. What do you think is the legacy today for unions and for the U.S. left of the kind of wholesale repression of the Wobblies, of the industrial workers of the world, in the early 20th century?
I think that what happened to the union, to the IWW, created a wariness on the part of unionists and leftists in general in this country about the state that I think has contributed to a willingness of many in this tradition through much of the 20th century and even today to seek accommodations with the state, compromises with the state. And to think twice about engaging in the kind of radicalism that marked the IWW. And I say that as someone who, despite, you know, my commitment to treating this subject in an objective way, very much admire what the organization did, what it tried to accomplish, and what it endured. And so I don't say this as a criticism of the IWW, or for that matter, as a kind of unqualified endorsement of what the union was trying to do. But I do think that one of its legacies was to create this very cautious attitude about engaging in the kind of radicalism, the kind of militancy that was the IWW's stock in trade. In that period. And I think that in turn has had some important effects in the history of American labor and the American left, where the kind of left-wing unionism that that replaced the IWW's version during the New Deal period particularly was all about making compromises with the state, was all about forming coalitions with, as I note in the book, the very progressives who a generation earlier had played such a central role in persecuting the IWW. And by making those compromises, those unionists set American labor in many ways on the course that's led it to where it is today. where there is where the IWW has resurged in some ways, in some interesting and in some ways impressive ways, but where the kind of radicalism that you saw with the organization in the 19-teens and 1920s is hard to find. And the kind of skepticism about the state and the kind of willingness to go it alone, to organize workers, for workers to organize themselves and to prosecute their aims and goals themselves without bothering to form these alliances with the state or with progressives who are prominent in the state, that kind of unionism is difficult to find today, and it certainly doesn't have the sort of prominence it had in the 19-teens and 1920s during the high water mark of the IWW and its activism.
Ahmed White, it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Ahmed White is Nicholas Rosenbaum Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's the author of Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers, published by UC Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He's also the author of The Last Great Strike, Little Steel, the CIO, and the Struggle for Labor Rights in New Deal America. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. Please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.